Penguin Random House Audio presents Oh, My Mother, A Memoir in Nine Adventures. This is the author, Connie Wang.
献给老爷.
Introduction. In Chinese, the closest expression to Oh My God is 我的妈呀. It's an interjection. A polite expletive, something to say when you're out of words. But there's no God present in the phrase, and I like the Chinese version better because it feels more like the truth. Translated literally, it means, oh, my mother, the first person I think of when I'm on the cusp of losing it or putting it all together. I think about my own mother, Qing Li, so often that I feel it must be unhealthy. I think about her reflexively. I wish she were here right now. I wonder what she's doing. I should call her. But also deliberately and resolutely, imagining all 5'2" of her standing in front of me, scrutinizing what I'm doing. I find myself thinking about Qing when I do anything new, when I do anything I realize has become routine. I think about her when I encounter exotic ideas, exciting situations, and unbearable emotions. Periodically, despite my best efforts, I write down these thoughts for others to read. I say despite because she is not someone I ever wanted to write about. Because to write about your mom, especially if it's your job to write, is to reveal that you have nothing much to write about in the first place. After all, in the vastness and pastness of human history, one of the few universal truths is that everyone has a mom, and everyone feels some sort of way about her. On a more specific front, it's entirely too obvious for a first-generation East Asian immigrant to have a filial piety complex, to loiter in a mother-shaped shadow. And yet, I have continued to put my thoughts about Qing on paper, over and over, in published essays and Instagram captions, in texts with friends who are forever inquiring after her, in reported pieces I wrote as a journalist, in which quoting your own mother is usually about as constructive or impressive as bringing a teddy bear to battle. By force of personality, influence, and blood, my mother has been the angel and the devil on my shoulders, the little voice in my head, and the creative muse that I have pushed against and climbed upon. This book is an attempt to explain my fascination with my mother, who is by many measures a very ordinary woman. She still lives in the same suburban home my sister and I grew up in and has held a position as an accountant at the same company that's employed her for more than 25 years. She has been married to my father for 35 years and had two kids who grew up to be, by most standards, perfectly fine. This vision of her and of the four of us is what used to dominate my understanding of myself as the product of a pattern, as a member of a lonely Chinese family inside a two-story build-a-home, each of us playing our roles exactly as written. The engineer father, perpetually beleaguered at work, the tiger mom with a temper, the prickly elder daughter, and the rebellious baby sister. There was a glossy black piano in the living room and plastic wrap on the remote control, and bills were opened the day they arrived in the mail. The normalcy of this side of Qing sits in contrast to our diverse eccentricities, character quirks I long assumed were formed out of an internal need to be seen as one of a kind. A reoccurring theme of this book, if you'll allow me a bit of a spoiler, is that I am wrong about a lot, especially when it comes to her. Qing has always insisted that she was uncategorizable by either personality tests or astrological designation, that she had more in common with the celebrities of the world than with the other moms who dropped off their kids for Chinese school on Saturdays. Her body naturally fits into runway fashion samples. Her favorite meal is two creme brulees. Even when she was a child, born the youngest and frailest of her family during the last year of China's Great Leap Forward, her refined taste meant that all the rationed white sugar, sesame paste, and eggs went to fancy, feeble, fussy Qing Li. Her peculiar philosophies, why townhouses are bad investments, snakes in the walls, why Scandinavians are the noblest of white people, universal health care, why drumstick ice cream cones are a healthy breakfast option, there are nuts, more on all of that later, burrow into the brains of any who hear them, little disruptive prods against logic, sense, and fact. I first started writing about Qing during a period in the 2010s when the personal essay had become pervasive. Those days, it seemed like every story was, in some way, a story about identity. The search for it, the lack of it, the compulsion over projecting it, presenting it, and having it be reflected back by others, magazine covers, and television shows. especially in my line of work, first as a fashion editor and then as a writer at an online publication geared toward women on the fringes, everyone was obsessed with finding themselves and for others to see and hear and affirm the selves they found. I was familiar with the search. I had been looking my entire life. There was a place, I imagined, where my tastes, my ambitions, my struggles, and my values were everyone else's, too. I read voraciously, hoping to find the treasure map in text, and I watched TV looking for myself, for a clue about some place I could go, where life could be more than eating, sleeping, and studying, more than just performing the mechanics of living. That era of my life could be described as a professionally sanctioned, personally motivated search for belonging, and it took me to the farthest coasts I could manage, in dizzying circles around the globe, to dinner tables and neighborhoods and closed rooms and wide open spaces, whose only common denominator was its foreignness to me. But the accumulation of these trips I've taken, with Ching either next to me in the passenger seat or just on my mind, have shown me that my search was doomed, at least in the approach I initially took. I'm excited to tell you why. During those years, I wrote about Ching in what I now see as a dishonest way. The facts were true, but the motivations were mine. How I portrayed her, as wise and resilient, a victim and a curiosity, was how I genuinely understood her, as a projection of myself. The truth is that I did not understand her then, as I was preoccupied with understanding myself, and after writing a book about her, I know with some certainty that I do not understand her now. But there is a difference between then and now, I swear. This book is about the difference. Before I first presented Ching with the idea of this book, I was unsure of how she would react. Would she be flattered? Upset? Her response surprised me. "People want to hear about immigrants suffer," she said, her brows sinking into deep rivulets. "You know, Mama is boring. No bad things happen, just weird ideas." Since then, I have had 1,000 conversations about those weird ideas and the circumstances through which they were formed. I have gotten to know that "no bad things" was a rose-colored statement, and I've come to see why Ching chooses to approach her life this way. This is our memoir, a long personal essay, if you will, and it was forged through shared fact-checking. Ching was the first person to read each chapter as it was written, and she is this book's first editor. Every word you hear here has first passed under her red pen. In witnessing Ching's involvement in telling her own story, of the sections where she challenged my recollections and the places where she gave me elbow room to paint the picture on my own, I am convinced that her story is the best response to her own pessimistic assumption that all folks want from immigrants are tragic tales of trauma, or happy assurances that everything is fine, that the American dream is still on offer. Her story is captivating not because of the hijinks or catastrophes, of which there are many, or in the happily ever afters, of which there are also many, but rather because of her capacity to forever change, evolve, and surprise. Put simply, this is a book about the noteworthy places we've visited, both physical and otherwise, and what we've gotten out of them, the intangible souvenirs of our sated curiosities, the opportunities to shuck lies from their shells, to glimpse futures that could or could never have been ours, to give us a real reason to be angry with each other in order for us to share why we had been angry with ourselves. Trip by trip, I came to understand that my mother was indeed one of a kind, just like she's always insisted. And she, with some tens of thousands of miles behind her, came to see that the humble life she had found herself living has been nothing short of a triumph. Prologue. "I'm supposed to be meeting my mom in America," I told her in Mandarin at the airport. I was 2, old enough to talk, but too young to remember who she was, despite the fact that just 6 months prior, I had spent every day of my life with her. "Is my mom you?" "That's me," Ching responded, asking if it was all right if she held me. In her arms, I was much heavier than she expected. But then again, everything in America had been heavier, harder, and dirtier than how she remembered things in China. Back in G9, Ching had been a college-educated book editor at a prestigious publishing house with an influential family, close friends, and an apartment filled with pretty things she bought with her own money. Her new husband had promised her that America was going to be even better. But here in Nebraska, She had no job. She picked up odd shifts at a Chinese restaurant that's
sample complete. Ready to continue?